This is Henry for Bondi Tunes International in Sydney, Australia. Thomas Booker is our North America correspondent. A memory of a moment in Thomas Booker's life growing up in a small town in central Texas, USA. Also recollections of the tour of churches from the late 50s to the late 60s and the sudden appearance of cult Christianity. Little did Thomas understand what he was seeing and what would be the result of it 20 years later.
The Underground Church of Kerr County. Grandmothers and aunts used to tell me that God made me. That was one of the assertions that began my religious upbringing. I have no real recollections of attending my first church service, but I do have an early recollection that I can recall, and it must have been during a visit at my grandparents in Dallas, Texas. All I can remember is being in a room full of people and a deep-voiced man standing in front of the crowd. I am pretty certain that I was in a Southern Baptist church, and I remember the man getting louder and louder as if he were incrementally terribly angry, and he scared me and I started to cry, and I had to be taken out of the church. When my family moved to New Orleans, I had more consciousness of being in a church. By that time, my mother and father switched to the Methodist Church, the church my father was raised in. I attended Sunday school, but there was no religion taught. There was just such a thing as vacation Bible school, and I was taken on a trip to Audubon Park, and all the kids were expected to bring food and share with each other. My favorite sandwich was peanut butter and banana on white bread. My mother made plenty of sandwiches for me to share. But when at the park with my fellow Christians, my offer of swapping a peanut butter and banana sandwich with another kid's ham or bologna, the other kids reacted with near revulsion, and I was excluded from the Christian fellowship that I was supposed to experience. This was not any sort of childhood trauma, because I really liked peanut butter and banana, and I still do to this day. That church in New Orleans, I think, still exists. It is on St. Charles Street, and on a really humid day in June, I was fascinated to watch a large steel-framed opening near to the church. As we walked by, I watched the work crew carrying blocks of ice with really big tongs from the back of the truck to the hole in the ground, and there was a roar associated with the ice sliding into the blackened pit, where I was briefly allowed to peer into to see all the ice blocks floating in the darkness. That pit was the air conditioning for the church. The Methodist Church in New Orleans was at least a neutral experience, except for the thrill of the ice pit, which was really interesting and slightly scary. Circumstances my family followed bounced us around until we arrived in the charming, smallish town of Kerrville, Texas, roughly 100 kilometers northwest of San Antonio. It was the perfect town for being a young, parapubescent male, most all points of hanging out being downtown, where the Arcadia Movie Theater offered Saturday afternoon movie selections, a river that was held back by a town dam, an old clunky steel truss bridge that offered the park area across the river. There was a purported mental hospital on the far side of the park that stood as a metaphor when we lads teased each other. Man, you're going to get sent across the river. There was countryside, hilly, rocky, and all sorts of peripheral parts of town where young boys on bicycles could have extended adventures and barely emerge alive from many of them. Afternoons after school, I could bicycle home and have the house to myself for a few hours. I had the TV all to myself, and later in the evening, with my parents at home, I was free to watch all sorts of interesting, sometimes weird TV, along with standard network television shows. All sorts of things were happening around me. Tension and disorder as generated by a sister and a brother in high school, parents struggling with the household budget and the usual life challenges. But I was barely aware of any of that. There was sort of a tour young boys on bicycle could take sometimes before the start of movies at the Arcadia. There was a whole business district in the town where there was a JCPenney's, Peterson Hospital. We could ride the elevator up to the very top floor that was a storage for all sorts of weird medical equipment and other objects, made it look like a laboratory for a mad scientist, but it also had a great view of downtown Kerrville. There was Shriner's department store that had a clothing section, a shoe department, other departments, and the sporting goods area, dominated by a taxidermy reconstruction of a polar bear. Whenever I needed new shoes, my mother would take me to the shoe department, where there was a tall, lean man who wore a suit and brown wingtip shoes. He was polite but never really engaged. He had a chiseled-looking face, almost looked Native American, close piercing eyes, and a no-nonsense manner about him, wielding his Brannock device, acknowledging the approval of my mother, and making the sale with but a slight smile and remote courtesy. I had no decision about the shoe choice. In the new town, my parents searched the available churches, and I, being the youngest, had to accompany them. They tried the Baptist church, the preacher did not make me cry this time, and the Methodist church, and for some reason they settled on St. Peter's Episcopal Church. I had no understanding nor any great awareness about the choice of churches, but there we were attending to the tenuous branch of the Royal Anglican Assembly and the Church of England. The further I got into puberty, I was eventually called upon, commanded, to become an acolyte, otherwise known in the Catholic Church as an altar boy. I was also required to enter confirmation class. That was the Protestant version of catechism, a step I had to take when reaching the threshold of adolescence that allowed me to accept the Eucharist. The priest at the church was never a threat to us altar boys. He was such a bland personality. He seemed as though passion and belief were surgically removed from him along with circumcision. We were never in danger from him. As is the imperative of parapubescent boys, we eventually established a hangout and hung out. There was a drainage channel for the neighborhood where we had our hangout. It was bordering an empty lot and channeled all the water flow collected by the neighborhood adjacent. The channel emptied into Town Creek, where a dam held back the creek and formed a small little reservoir. An earlier gang of boys channeled a handmade cave into the walls of the drain, and there inside we had a cave. So the friend of mine, who will go unnamed, hung out there, as did I, and we built fires and smoked cigarettes, stayed up all night, and had adventures, many of which we barely survived. The unnamed best friend's family also attended the same church where I was an acolyte, and the unnamed best friend's mother was very active in St. Peter's Episcopal Church, taught Sunday school, and was ardent in her faith. My friend's father was an insurance salesman who drove around in a three-gear manual sedan, three on a tree, the shift lever being on the steering column. It was sort of a trademark, and my father bought a policy from him. So my friend was a bad boy like the rest of the gang, and we hung out, spent nights at each other's house, went to movies, explored the town, shoplifted from the local pennies, played 13-hour-long games of Risk, watched monster movies on Friday nights, built bonfires, approached the plot of Lord of the Flies, played pool, hung out at the bowling alley, and things lumped along. I was not constantly hanging out with the Town Creek rats, as we called ourselves, and there were certain solitary moments I could enjoy at home watching educational television on the nights that network TV was too blech. Our educational channel was starved for programming in the evenings, and it tended to find all sorts of off-the-wall films and documentaries, mainly left over from Canadian broadcasting. In my solitude, I could watch really interesting science shows and history shows, all from a different point of view. There was one documentary about voodoo in South America, describing the various ways the practitioners drove themselves into trance states and began to channel a particular god or native spirit. The film showed them entering their conversations with entities from another realm. It seemed to be a bit spooky, but I paid attention. Had other friends, and on occasions we would bicycle to other parts and borders of the town. On the northwest side of town, out the highway to the northwest, was a nearly vacant field where resided Kerrville's own radio station, KERV. It was a 10 kilowatt or so restricted broadcast station, on from sunrise to sunset, with an operator-announcer who was constantly bored with his job. Somehow, we bicycled near the station and gawked at the towers, speculating on how the station worked, and the operator once invited us in. We got to go watch him run the board, spin disks, log the transmitter readings as per FCC requirements. It became a regular stop every couple of weeks. One day I brought her album of songs by Tom Lear, and he played it on one Sunday. No one was listening, and few if any heard, so the operator did not get in trouble. There was another Sunday I witnessed from the control room, but I have to digress. Kerrville was not completely a separatist town, but it certainly was racist. There were sections of town where black people lived, sections where Mexican heritage people lived, and by that time, they all attended public schools. Sometimes, when I went to the gang hangout on Town Creek on a Sunday evening, I could hear the distant sounds of the singing of the black church in another part of town. It drifted over the creek. Somehow I was moved because I was alone, the creek was peaceful, and the singing was very touching and very sincere. Along with black people and Mexican-American people, there was an underclass. They were poor, white, and pretty much alienated. One of the ways they could be seen earning a living was to chop the trunks of the local cedar trees to make fence posts. So they hacked down cedar trees, sold them for posts, and they earned the demeaning nickname of hackers. Despite the ways they managed to eke out a living, they remained working poor. I had some of those poor folks as classmates, but rarely did I interact with them, and they were somewhat loners. Then there was that Sunday when we were hanging out at KERV. Old beat-up trucks and cars showed up, and the bedraggled passengers emerged, bringing with them their guitars, banjos, drums, cymbals, and voices. They were all ardent, born-again Christians, and they were at the station to have a praise session. They were given an hour, and they did use that hour to sing all sorts of amazing down-home song and praise, and just like I saw on the educational television channel, they worked themselves up to a spiritual frenzy, thanking Jesus for their lives and livelihoods. Some of the players were schoolmates, and I was astonished at how they came out of themselves, not timid, not reserved, not keeping to themselves, but praying and singing and praising. Even when their hour was up, they reconvened in the parking lot and carried on for another good hour or so until it was time to pack up and go home. That was rather an amazing sight to witness. And then there was my friendship with my chum and his family. Something began to work on him. His mother began to demand his attendance at certain meetings. The family had abandoned St. Peter's Episcopal Church. There was one sign of the break when, during a service, I sat next to my friend as he rolled his eyes listening to the liturgy of the 1929 Book of Common Prayer. Yea, it is very meet and right and our bounden duty. What were these silly words, his eye roll tended to say. I had to remain a friend, and when he and his parents abandoned St. Peter's Episcopal, they were going somewhere else, as was he. There was the appearance in town of a group up with people. They were a wholesome, all-American singing group that was about to combat the emergence of counterculture. I had to attend the concert in the Kerrville Municipal Auditorium. There was a Billy Graham movie production being shown at the Arcadia Theater. I had to go. There was a traveling minister who held a revival at Tyvee High School, Antler Stadium. I had to go. Conversations with my friends started to become rather difficult, and sometimes testy. I was afraid of starting a fight. My friend tended to present a facade of toughness, always talking about fighting his way out of this or that situation. His tendency toward aggression might have had roots in the fact that he was a young child when he was diagnosed with, as I was told, polio. The tissue in one of his upper arms was surgically removed, and the arm restrung such it was partially limited in range of motion. I was never aware of such a procedure being practiced on a polio victim, but there was some challenging affliction he was trying to overcome as he entered his own journey into manhood. But as he was slowly being dragged into a strange territory, some part of him did not want to go, or so it seemed. In time, my friend began to confide in me. His mother and father had discovered a new church. It was not the ritualistic worship of the mainline Catholic or Methodist or even the Episcopal Church. All of those are not churches. They were following a false god according to what he was being taught. Then he confided that I should not be sharing this knowledge with anyone else, and he told me about a small gathering every week in a house on the edge of town. This was a new church, an underground church. He then started to tell me about the ultimate experience of speaking in tongues, and if I went with him, I might witness it. I began to recall that documentary I saw on educational TV, the filmed record of a voodoo frenzy, and I sort of wanted to see if that might be a similar phenomena, even though I was totally creeped out by the whole business. So one Sunday evening, the sun going down, I went with my friend and his parents to a house in a neighborhood near Antler Stadium on the fringe of Kerrville. The house was tidy, cozy, and a bit close, and there were people sitting in cushy chairs arrayed in the living room. There was a bit of a wait, my memory is fuzzy, and then there began some sort of prayer recital and perhaps some subdued song until the leader of the group entered the room. The leader was the shoe salesman in Shriners Department Store. I cannot recall what was said and what was done in that room that night. I kept looking around, waiting for signs of frenzy and especially for someone speaking in tongues, but it did not happen. I was glad when it was all over and I could go home. After this event and my lack of any enthusiasm over what I witnessed there, my relationship with my friend began to evaporate. Not just with me, my friend began to isolate from the rest of the river rats, and he began to be bitter and hostile, and I believe I was witnessing someone entering a personal prison overseen by his parents. We could not have any conversations, nor drool over Playboy magazine centerfolds, or enjoy cigarettes with him around, and in time, the Town Creek rats began to evaporate as the club due to other dynamics having to do with growing up. Not just with me, my friend began to isolate from the rest of the river rats, and he began to be bitter and hostile, and I believe I was witnessing someone entering a personal prison overseen by his parents. In time, I was released from my responsibility of being an acolyte in the Episcopal Church. I released myself from religion altogether about 20 years later, but I still have a fondness for the 1929 Book of Common Prayer and its most articulate expression of Emperor Constantine's political document. I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth and all things visible and invisible. I believe in his only begotten Son, Jesus Christ, born of Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, dead, and buried. He descended into hell. On the third day he rose again to sit at the right hand of God. From there he will judge both the quick and the dead. Thank you.
For Bondi Tunes International, this is Thomas Booker from San Antonio, Texas, USA.
Bondi Tunes International, from the golden sands of Bondi Beach, across your world.
This is Ling Pang for Bondi Tunes International, and I talked with American music producer Tony Manta, supporting autism awareness and understanding, courtesy of Livewire. Nice to have you back, Tony. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Since the last time we talked, I believe your project that you worked on several years ago in connection with autism, and it started with a beautiful song, Why Not Me? And it's so welcomed by the world, reaching out to a lot of people. And you've been so busy. You've been doing podcasts. You appeared on numerous TV. Before we do that, you were originally from Nashville. You originally started as a musician. As a young man, you have appeared and sang and produced record and play music on stage. And then things sort of grew from there, and you became a music producer and managing some amazing artists like Debbie Campbell, the daughter of Glen Campbell, and many others like Bobby Wilson, you know, all these amazing artists. From then on, a few years ago, you decided to sing again, and everything sort of started from there, isn't it, Tony?
Yes, it's pretty amazing because I started this song just for entertainment, something to do. Pandemic had hit, all recordings had stopped, performances had stopped. You know, everybody I managed had no shows, nothing to do. So it was like I had always planned on doing another project just for the fun of it for me. So I decided this was the perfect time. So I worked on it, and then a friend of mine sent me a song, "Why Not Me," which is about not giving up, just keep moving, and that's kind of what I put on my social media all the time. So it just made sense. So I recorded it, and then I put it out as a pop song, but I put a steel in it to give it texture like the Eagles used to do. For some reason, everyone kind of thought that made it more country, so everybody pushed it on the countryside, which didn't matter to me. Whatever they want to call it, they call it, as long as they like it.
Yeah.
I put it out, but the interesting part is I put it out and I did a video to pay respects to our first responders.
That's right. Yeah, I remember that.
And then from there, after it was all finished and all got finished at radio and all the interviews and every and the video and everything, I thought that was pretty much it. And that's when a lady called me and asked me if I could do something for them, which she's a speech therapist for autistic children. So from there, I re-recorded the song and I did a video with autistic people and special needs here in Nashville. And it just blew up and started going, and just things kept building. And here we are today.
So in 2022, you released a single called "Why Not Me," supporting autism awareness around the world. At the time, you didn't really expect that it would sort of appeal so widely. So are you actually impressed by the interest that people are showing in this project?
Yeah, I mean, when I first started it, I just didn't know, you know, what to expect. I just put it out there, and I thought that maybe it might be something that would gather a little traction and get a little interest, and that would be it. And it just the video, I mean, it's close to like 240,000 views, and the song just kept building, it just kept building, you know. So yeah, I mean, I'm pretty amazed at how it's grown.
So how did the podcast side begin?
Well, how that happened is I had this opportunity come to me from New York on a business podcast. They wanted me to co-host 7 episodes, so I did. And I told them that we had to take, and they wanted to cover my music career and the business. And I told them that the last 10 minutes had to be focused on the video that I had just done for autism. Mm. So we did that, and I wound up doing 7 shows, and they actually offered me 10 more shows, but I just didn't think that was the right fit. I thought that it was just too business orientated, and people that talk about autism and all that, they're not listening to business shows for autism. Mm. So I started thinking, you know, maybe I'll just do a podcast, couple of shows a month, just see how it goes. And I took and did my due diligence, and I did my homework and figured out how to put podcasts out there and the best way to market them, and just covered all the bases that I could. So I put it out there, and it wound up going. I put my first episode the last week of June, and then I had 2 in July. And then by August, I had so many people calling me that wanted to be on the show that I turned it into a weekly episode, and I had recorded enough to go for the rest of the year. And now the people that I'm recording are for January and February of next year.
What amazed me is the story that they tell you when you do the podcast revealed a lot of stories about people living with autism. Is that sometimes amaze you that the impact you would have on them by raising awareness and hopefully raising funds towards it, by the music that you produced, helping their transitions from a student or from a young person into an adult, into the business world? Is that the aim of that?
Well, actually, there is. I'm funding this whole podcast 100% myself. I have not I've not taken on any sponsors yet. And the reason why is because I really didn't think that the impact would be big enough to impress a sponsor, you know, and have a sponsor to want to come on and say, hey, we'd like to help you. So that's part of the reason why I don't have a sponsor. And the other part is I didn't want anyone coming in wanting to change my approach and how I do this, because I think that what I've done and how I'm doing it is the reason why it's becoming more successful, because I'm not pushing anybody to tell me anything they don't want to tell me. Mm-hmm. I'm letting them.
You let them tell you in their own comfort zone.
Exactly. Yeah? I think the number one thing that I've heard from everybody that gives me feedback on it is that they can relate to the people that are telling the stories.
Because when a family, having a member of a family living with autism, it's not just a single person that's affected. It affects the entire family. They need to adjust. They need to understand. As a family, nobody is left out. So therefore, it requires a tremendous of a consideration and understanding to go forward. So I think it requires tremendous energy and understanding. I think the podcast you're doing actually sort of enlighten people's understanding, people who have no exposure to directly with people with autism. This understanding is valuable. I totally understand that, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm glad that you used that word, understanding, because when I first was trying to come up with a slogan for my podcast, I started looking around at different entities that dealt with autism, and I saw that they always use autism awareness and acceptance, and that's kind of what the autistic world promotes, is awareness and acceptance. But I think they really missed the whole thing, is because I look at people that are aware that autism exists. And I look at myself, because I was aware of autism.
But why, tell me, how do you become aware of so much?
Well, the thing is I become aware of it because I would see different people talking about it.
Okay, yeah.
But the thing is I'm aware of it, and I'll accept that it's there because I'm aware of it. But the thing is I had no comprehension or understanding of what autism is, because I don't have anybody that's autistic in my family. I didn't know anybody that was autistic, that friends of mine. And the irony of it is since I've been doing this, I've actually had a couple of friends tell me that, you know, I've never told you this, but I'm autistic. Mm-hmm. You know, so I've known some autistic people without knowing, but my whole feeling is that. So this is my slogan: autism awareness, acceptance, and understanding. So I went out and I trademarked that so that I could make that my slogan. And I feel that this podcast has to help people, because in the understanding end of it, because when I was listening to podcasts before I started mine, I listened to a lot of them, and just the conversations they had was so far above my head.
Yeah.
I had no comprehension or understanding of what they were talking about. So I'm going to myself, if a new couple, 25, 26 years old, they've had their first child or second child or whatever child it may be, and then all of a sudden that child's 3 or 4 years old and it's not hitting its markers, They don't know what autism is because they've never dealt with it, then all of a sudden they're forced into this world or thrown into this world of autism, not knowing what to do, how to take care of their child, what's best for it. And I looked at them as the same as me listening to these podcasts, being overwhelmed with a scientific talk, but not being able to understand it. So I figured that if I could start my podcast and just have people, real people, telling real stories of how they got their kids diagnosed, what they went through, some of the challenges they faced, you know, all these things, if someone new is hearing this, then maybe that'll help them. And then also, if someone else is going through something that someone else went through and they hear it, they might say, you know, I'm going through this with my son or daughter now. Maybe this will help. So it's just my podcast is I made it so they can be informative, so that people can hopefully gain some knowledge from it and a better understanding of what people that are autistic or have autistic family members have to deal with on a daily basis. Because like one person said to me, and this is so important, she said, when I go to school and I sit at my desk and I get up and I leave to go home, autism doesn't stay at my desk. It follows me home.
Right.
And it's going to follow me for the rest
of my
life.
It's for life. People live with that for life.
Exactly.
So you got a lot of help, Tony. You're reaching out not only your podcast alone. In UK, you do regular interviews with the BBC and Livewire. Your podcast has been well received by the media outlets. You are being interviewed by NBC, Fox News, PBN Network in New York, Talk Radio Europe as well. Do you find this is really overwhelming, that the impact you personally have created, Tony?
Well, you know, just this week here, I am on the Women's Network in London. That's Dr. Anna Kennedy. Yeah. She interviewed me on her about autism, and they have a 1 a.m. and a 1 p.m. show. And they're having me on that show all this week, so yeah. I mean, I've actually gotten the opportunity to speak with many different people in the UK and parts of Europe and all over the world, and it's been very informative. It's been very interesting. People telling their different stories. You know, the feedback I've been getting is just basically that they find it very informative, and the most thing that they find that they tell me is that being in the autistic world, they can relate to the stories that are being told. But I've also had some that said they've lived with autism or been around autism for 25 or 30 years, and they're still learning something new from these different people. I feel very grateful that people are following it and liking it and giving good feedback. Hopefully it's helping. That's the main thing.
The ranking of your podcast is also ranking really high in the US Apple Health and Fitness chart. What's that about?
Well, you've got different platforms that have the podcast, and like Apple, Spotify, you know, you can go down the list, iHeart, you know, they've all got these platforms, but they'll have their charts on the most listened to podcasts and the feedback that they're getting. So I've been, and because Apple is huge, so they're in
pretty
much every country there is. So yes. I've shown up in the Apple podcast charts in the UK. I've shown up in the Apple podcast charts in Argentina, South Africa, India, France, just Ireland this week popped up, because Canada, the US, I mean, so it's getting all around the world. But the most defining thing is that it's got the staying power now, so it's staying. Like lots of times you'll see the podcast pop up, then it'll be gone, pop up, be gone. And now I'm finding that in some places it's starting to get some staying power. And just this week here, I had the 11th most listened to podcast in the United States.
Excellent.
So I'm trying to build a podcast that where people can listen to it, be engaged with it, and then hopefully learn from it.
Because you've been a successful singer and musician and songwriter, you've got a beautiful singing voice. When I first heard the song, Why Not Me, you did two versions of it. There's an original version and the second version. I'd like to play that on this show. Tell me a little bit about that song, the second version. Is it a little bit more rocky or something, more pop?
It's a little more on the adult contemporary pop. I use a violin in it rather than a fiddle. I tried to make it more adult contemporary so that it could branch over into that pop side and be completely different than the original version, which had a steel in it for texture that people kind of thought was more countryish. You know, so I wanted to have enough difference between the two of them so that people listening would understand that, number one, there is two different versions of it. And number two, there's two different versions for a reason, because it's promoting two different entities.
Tell us, you have a link.
It's available on all the platforms.
Yeah.
But if they want to buy it directly from me, they can go to tonymantor.com and go to my store. I've got a link there where if they want to donate and help the project, they can.
Okay.
Or they can give $1 or they can give $5 or whatever they want to give. I'm not. And then they can buy the music, they can buy the CD, and all that's going to do is that money is going to go into the pot to help fund the expenses that it's costing me to do what I'm doing.
Would you like to introduce a song, please?
Sure. Here's my latest song supporting autism awareness around the world, Why Not Me?
Thank you.
There's a mountain wide and high. It reaches halfway to the sky. In my heart, I know that I'm supposed to climb. Well, the fear's down in my soul. Tell me I might lose control. No matter what they say, I'm climbing anyway. Why not me? Why can't I? I'll never know if I don't try. Yeah, I might fail or I might fall. It's just a mountain after all. So why not me? There's an ocean deep and blue. It stretches out in front of you. On the other side is everything you've dreamed of. So say a prayer and set sail. Stay the course, you will prevail. When the doubts start whispering, just lift your voice and sing. Why not me? Why can't I? I'll never know if I don't try. The storms may rage, the sea might roar. It's just an ocean, nothing more. So why not me? Why not me? Why can't I? I'll never know if I don't try. Yeah, I might fail or I might fall. It's just a mountain after all. Just an ocean, nothing. Why not me? Yeah, why not me? Yeah, why not me?
This is Ling Pang for Bonang Tunes International, and I talked with Tony Manta.
You're a good friend around the planet.
You're listening to BondiTunes.com from Sydney, Australia. And we have Bob Gallico, North American correspondent, on the line. Bob, I don't think you and I have ever spoken in an interview like this on this.
No, this is the first time, Henry, yeah.
So what's it all about? What are we going to talk about?
Well, as is well known to a number of people, Henry, we have a connection, which is, of course, Radio Nova. But we have another connection that is known to only three people. It's you and I and your lovely lady, Caroline. And it stems from my days of treading the boards of the Irish theatre, dear boy, in the 1950s.
Yes. Ah, yes. And, you know, I've always, working with you back in the 80s, even on Radio Nova, I've always meant to ask you what brought you to Ireland.
It was a DC-7. Brief pause while listeners laugh hysterically, I don't think. Anyway, actually, I'll tell you what happened if you put a cup of tea on and just sit down and shut up and I'll tell you.
Yeah, I'll do that.
I spent a couple of years in radio. That was the first work that I did. And then I had the opportunity to join the Arthur Theatre of Virginia, which it's world famous. Gregory Peck actually started there. He was one of their alumni. And I did 2 years of summer stock and touring. And at the end of that time, I figured I was ready to be a Broadway or television star. And so I went to New York. Unfortunately, Broadway and television wasn't ready for me. So I was there for a few months, and I did a few bits and pieces on television, walk-ons and one-line parts. But I could see that I really wasn't getting anywhere. It was very tough to break into the business even then, even tougher now. And then one time my stepmother gave a tea party, and she invited me along to meet some people. And one of the people that I met there was a lady named Etty Elliman. Now, Etty was the wife of Louis Elliman, and Louis Elliman was the manager of the Gaiety Theatre in Dublin. And he was also the head of the Rank film chain there. And we got to talking, and I told her what I was doing, what I was trying to do, what my ambition was, and that I wasn't really getting anywhere. And she said these fatal words, "Well, if you ever get to Ireland, look us up, and Louis will get you into the theater." And I thought, hello, the Irish Theater had a great reputation. I thought, well, if I go there and work in the Irish Theater and then come back, maybe some doors would open. I mean, the reputation was huge at the time, the Abbey and the Gate. And actually, the Abbey reputation was undeserved at the time because they were kind of in the doldrums. It was the Gate Theatre with Hilton Edwards and Michael McLaremore that was doing the best work at the time. But anyway, I thought, okay. So I said, look, I'll come. So over the next 6 months, I planned a thing. We kept in touch. And then on a certain day in July, I had booked my flight, and I was all set to go. At that point, let me say, I almost didn't leave for Ireland. That an entity in my hometown of New Rochelle had the power to prevent me from going and possibly changing my whole future. But that's another story for another day, Henry.
Yes, I was going to ask what entity.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you about that another time.
Okay.
Anyway, I did leave, and I was met at Shannon by Louis and Etty Elliman. Now, Louis, who was a most kind and generous man, always backed up his wife's words. Anyway, we drove to Dublin. He found me a place to stay, some digs, and he indeed did introduce me around to people in the Irish theater. And the first show I did was actually about a month later. I played a messenger in Othello. This was Andrew McMaster. He was a great Shakespearean actor in Ireland, and he was having a season in the Gaiety Theatre. And I played a messenger. I had one line. Actually, I think in the Shakespearean version, because McMaster sometimes changed the plays slightly, there were about two lines, but I had this one line where I said something like, "The Ottoman fleet of some 30 sail approaches, my lord." So that was my line in that.
Was that just one line, Bob?
It was just one line.
Oh, sorry, two lines, was it?
Well, originally in the play, it was two lines, but I think he had cut it down to one line. So that was my theatrical debut in Ireland. Then a short time later, Louis got me to, with the Globe Theatre, who were just starting out as an entity in Ireland. And we did a play called The Seven-Year Itch. I was stage manager. And also, I played the voice of Richard's conscience. If you know the play, you hear his voice. It's an offstage voice. I'm offstage working with a microphone, which was kind of, I suppose,
wow. Per se.
Yeah, it kind of, you know, indicated what I might be doing
later
on.
I was going to say, that was kind of a predictive kind of thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, wasn't it, though? So I did that. And then the third show that I did there, a couple of months later, was a variety show called Gateway to Gaiety. And it was star Jimmy O'Dea, who was the premier comedian in Ireland at the time. Michael McLuhan was also in it, doing the Cask of Amontillado. Now, if you can imagine this dramatic thing right in the middle of a variety show. But anyway, but that third production is the one that brought about my meeting with the man destined to become your grandfather, Harry O'Donovan. And this is our connection. He was the longtime writing partner of the star of that show, Jimmy O'Dea. And look, I seem to have used up nearly all the time we have for the first part of this chat about Harry O'Dea. So I tell you what, let's end it all by hearing Harry himself. Now, he wasn't just a comedy writer, but he was also a performer. He toured, in fact, with a theatrical company in Ireland in his early days. But anyway, this is a recording he made of one of his comic songs called I'll Slip Out the Back.
I'm really most awfully worried and simply don't know what to do. Of course you can guess that I'm married. That's just what has me in the stew. I promised some pals I would join them and have a right jolly good time. They said if you can, come at 7, old man. And now it's 9:15. And I wanted to go out tonight, but my wife wouldn't let me. Either got a date with the boys, Kennedy's, Murphy's, O'Brien's and Malloy's. I never can do as I like, for she's always on my track. So when she locks up the front door, I'll slip out on the back. Now just as I came home this evening, my wife said to me, Harry dear, today I began the spring cleaning. The carpets want beating, I fear. I've spread them around the back garden. There's more on the landing and stairs. And when you've done that, underneath the hall mat, the flooring boards want some repairs. And I wanted to go out tonight, but my wife wouldn't let me. I've got a date with the boys, Kennedy's, Murphy's, O'Brien's and Malloy's. I never can do as I like, for she's always on my track. So when she locks up the front door, I slip out on the bag. And I wanted to go out tonight, but my wife wouldn't let me. I've got a date with the boys, Kennedy's, Murphy's, O'Brien's and Malloy's. I never can do as I like, for she's always on my track. So when she locks up the front door, I slip out on the back.
It's a Broadway melody. Like Cole Porter, Lorenz Hart was a witty lyricist whose clever rhymes enhanced many a Richard Rodgers melody. One of the most oft quoted are the lines he included in Mountain Greenery. Beans could get no keenery, ception in a beanery. Bless our mountain greenery home. Four unforgettable hit songs came out of their 1937 musical, Babes in Arms, Where or When, I Wish I Were in Love Again, My Funny Valentine, and The Lady is a Tramp. Of all the non-cast recordings of the last named, none is better performed, in my opinion, and the 1948 recording by Miss Lena Horne.
I've wined and dined on mulligan stew and never asked for turkey, as I hitched and hiked and grifted too from Maine to Albuquerque. Alas, I miss the bull's ox ball, and what is twice as sad, I was never at a party where they honored Noel Cad. But social circles spin too fast for me. My whole bohemia is the place to be. I get too hungry for dinner at 8. I like the theater, but never come late. I never bother with people I hate. That's why the lady is a tramp. I don't like crap games with barons and earls. Won't go to Harlem in ermine and pearls. Don't dish the dirt with the rest of the girls. That's why the lady is a tramp. I like the free, fresh wind in my hair. Life without care. I'm broke, that's no. Hate California, it's cold and it's dank. That's why the lady is a tramp. I go to Coney, the beach is divine. I go to ball games, the bleachers are fine. I get the columns and read every line. That's why the lady is a tramp. Not a fake. I like the rowing on Central Park Lake. I go to opera and stay wide awake. That's why the lady is a tramp. I like the green grass under my shoes. What can I lose? I'm flat, that's that. I'm all alone when I lower my lamp.
You're listening to Bondi Tunes International. I'm Henry in Sydney, Australia. A lot more coming up in less than 3 minutes in hour two of our show, The Chatcher.
O'Donovan.